The following podcast is a part of RadioMisfits.com.
Welcome to Misfits Making It. We're oddballs and we're doing cool stuff. I'm your host, Lauren LoJudice. This is the podcast version of the comedy shows I host around New York City and the road, the Misfit Variety Show, and all the shows at the Capiche Club Misfit Comedy Space down in Little Italy. Well, how's it going? What's up in your Misfit world? I've been on the road for a bit. Every year, my partner and I go away for the holidays because we don't have kids. No one misses us. And we realized during the pandemic, like, oh my God, now that we don't have to drive to all over the East Coast, we don't want to. And so we leave every year right before Christmas. And then that like gives us more time to sneak away without people realizing we're gone, because it's slow work-wise for most people then. And then we go far and we go somewhere crazy. And this year we were in Colorado, and then we went to go visit our friends in Hawaii, which is incredible. We also started working as of January 2nd, because we realized when we just have only surfing and not much going on around, we're like, let's just work, which is terrible. I need to be occupied at all times in order to actually take a break. So yeah, are we getting up at 4 a.m. to get to meetings? Like, absolutely. My therapist is going to be mad, but at least when I'm done with work, I get to go surf, and that's pretty dope. So trying to stay calm and do a lot of meditating these days, because we know it's about to change about our world, and we have to really just, I think this year, I'm just thinking a lot about like taking care of myself, mental health, so important. All right, so we're going to talk today to an artist who I admire so much, who creates art about this crazy world and in such an incisive and refreshing and innovative way, and will give you inspiration as we go into this period of insanity. Things are already insane, but I think it's going to be just... we got to keep making stuff, and this person will inspire you to do that. Now, before we get to this interview, reminder, please rate and review the podcast. Social proof is super important for misfits, because misfits trust other misfits to know what's good. Also, you can sign up at laurenlogie.com, or you can sponsor a podcast. We've made it accessible for individuals or companies to do so. And listen, if we get the sponsors, we'll put this out more often. Right now, it goes out about like every other week-ish, and we'll put it out every week if we get some sponsors. You could go to laurenlogie.com, click on listen and podcast, and contact us there. All right, so today we are interviewing performance artist Louise Orban. I saw these posters around Leith in Edinburgh when I was there for the festival. Leith is like a little bit outside the main area, and I saw these flyers for the show called Fame Hungry. And something about it, I was like, something about this, I'm like, is it a comedy? Is it theater? I wasn't sure, but the concept looked appealing. And it was a lot of, and Fame Hungry, it seemed to be from the poster, an exploration of like what it means to be online famous, what it means to create art in the online sphere. Something I'm really interested in, if you follow my Instagram, you know I have a character, an influencer character called Candace Twyla, who basically is my way of exploring what an influencer means in the most absurd sketch comedy kind of Buster Keaton-ish way. So I went and brought my friend, and we were blown away. He turned to me during these, like, this is the best thing I've seen. And it was so good. We're going to talk a lot about her show. We're going to talk a lot about, like, art making in this world. Also, it's Sunday, January 12th. And in a week or two, TikTok might be banned in the United States. Now, Fame Hungry has a focuses on TikTok. So even if it's not around anymore, I think it will be. But even if it's not, the conversation will be relevant, because online culture is not changing, not going anywhere. This idea of becoming famous online, getting licks, getting clicks. Listen, TikTok didn't invent it. It's been around. You're going to find it inspiring to hear about how Louise creates art, how she started on her path, how she's keeping going. Let's get to the interview with Louise Orban. All right, Louise Orban, thank you for joining us on Misfits Making It.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
All right, so tell everyone what you do, because you have such a cool career. And I don't even know how to, you do such cool stuff.
You do the cool. You're the coolest. So tell us how you're the coolest.
What, tell you like what I do or do the artist spiel thing?
I guess, I mean, what do you feel like you do at your heart? You know, it could be, it doesn't have to be like the artist for the grant, you know?
Yeah. So I guess like I describe myself as a performance artist, for the last like 15, not quite. Well, let's just say just under 15 years, I've been making performance and video works and also sometimes audio work. So I guess I'm kind of like a multidisciplinary artist around a variety of subjects, but they're normally something to do with like gender or violence or some like big sort of burning question I have about like things that I see in the world that often maybe irritate me or confuse me or puzzle me. So a lot of my work like has quite a long research journey, let's just say. And then the sort of end result tends to be a kind of like way of me making that like question or that research as live as possible. Yeah. I don't know if that was like the most abstract way of describing my art.
That does. I mean, it makes sense. And so like when you're, I'm so mystified by the performance art space, and I have lots of friends who are in it, and I'm always, so because it's like, basically you're interested in something and then you start working on it and you don't know exactly what it's going to look like or sound like or feel like. And then you then find a place to present it. And then figure out how to make that happen. Is that basically it?
Yeah. I mean, definitely. I think I think what is definitely true of what you just said is that like I never know what the thing is going to be at the beginning of the journey. So it's very much like, okay, here's the sort of theme, here's the research area, and then I think going on that journey, then I'll decide like, oh, okay, it makes most sense for what I'm exploring for that to be like an audio work or a gallery piece or, you know, a theater show. So I think, yeah, that's definitely true. In terms of then like finding like the presentation space or, you know, the programmer or where it's going to be on, I think that's something that is like getting clearer as I get older, I guess, and as my practice grows, because now I'm working more on a kind of like commission basis. So like here in London, I'll like get commissioned by a big theatre I'll know like where I'm taking it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, because they're basically like, here's the, you're going to do this here and we need you to do this thing. Yeah. So then do you approach them to do it?
It's kind of half and half, I'd say. Like, I think I've got like quite a good network of like spaces and sort of programmers in the UK that I have relationships with, and a little bit in Europe as well now, which is exciting. And yeah, so it's often like responding to, or it's, you know, it's one of those things, like I've found like the older I get, the more it's about like playing the long game, you know, like once 5 years ago, I mentioned to a programmer that I had an idea about making this show about X, Y, and Z. And then, you know, like 5 years later, they'll be like, hey, remember about that conversation we had? And then they'll say like, oh, we finally have a space for that. And so it's kind of one of those things, I think.
Yeah. So it's basically like people who believe in performance art and are like, the way to make this happen is we have to like invite them over and commission them to do it.
Yeah, definitely. I think like, I mean, I don't know what it's like in the States, but I'm finding that in the UK, there are less and less spaces now for like kind of like risky experimental work. So I think, you know, the people that are really invested in it out there, they really believe in it. It's, you know, it's like kind of burning fight for them. So I think, all the ones of us that are less left and that are thriving in this space, I think we're all just like desperately trying to find ways to make the work happen in whatever way it can, I guess.
Yeah. So you said left. Where is everyone else going? Where is everyone else? Did they vanish?
Where have they gone? I know it's the big question. I mean, so this is a massive question. I guess like, I don't know if this happened for you, but I think I did find like over the pandemic, I had loads of friends who left the arts. Mm. And, you know, they were like, this way of making a living is way too precarious.
Yeah.
So they went into other fields. But I also think like the thing that I would be like churlish not to say is that also, you know, I'm a woman in my mid-30s, and I found that reaching this age, I've also found a mass exodus of women leaving the arts because they want to have babies, and having babies means that they again have to find maybe like a more sustainable career, and or they have their children and then they find there's less and less space for working in the arts. And so yeah, that has definitely meant that a lot of my friends have left as well, which is sad.
It is. It is. I was just thinking yesterday, I was like, wow, having kids is like the worst decision you could make for your career.
No, right. Exactly. Unless you find some way to like start making your art about the experience of having children, which is also like what some of my friends have done as well. But I mean, for sure, it's like, yeah, having kids is expensive and it's time consuming and, you know, energy draining and all the things. And when you're already working in a field where there's so little resources and money and quite frankly, energy, yeah, it sometimes seems impossible, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, unless you just have like, like I do know of people who've been in the arts who have had kids and they've made it work, but they also had some sort of mysterious pile of money that paid for childcare and like help. Yep. Around the house. So the magic bunny has made it possible, but
absolutely. Or like a partner that doesn't work in the arts, for example.
Two income situation. And then that's how they do it. And then the partner who's going to be there to pick up the kids when you can't do all those things. Cause otherwise it's not possible. And I hate to I hate to be the bearer of bad news to people, but I'm like, you won't have the career you want.
Yeah.
Because you don't have the time.
No, exactly. And, you know, I think about like, you know, when you have those like sliding doors moments and you're like, okay, what if I'd had, you know, kids like 5 years ago at the same point that my best pal had friends or whatever, had kids. And I think, okay, so if I had children now and I'm doing this like massive tour at the moment for my show Fame Hungry, like, how would I make that work with kids? I have no idea. Would they stay at home? Would they have to come on the road with me?
Right.
Like, would I have to bring my partner along with me? Would I need to have childcare? Like, yeah, all those questions.
When it's already so hard, when it's already so hard to do.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So what has been, we'll talk about Fame Hungry for sure, but like what other of all the cool projects you've done, what is one you that stays close to your heart?
Oh, that's a really great question. I think, oh god, this is gonna sound like such a lame answer, but I think in a way like all my shows are really close to my heart. Like sometimes I think about them like kind of children, you know, like I often think about the creative process, like you're really like birthing something. And then there's a moment where like you've had your baby and then you have to put it out into the world. And then you see how your world, how the world responds to your children. And then, you know, you like stay with them for X amount of time. And then after that, you just have to like let them go on their own. And I think sometimes that feels quite sad and sometimes right to leave them behind. But, I think one project that I've been thinking about quite a lot recently, and I think this is kind of because Fame Hungry, my current show, is like a return to similar territory or similar themes, is kind of like the first big show that I made, which was in like 2013. So, wow, over 10 years ago now. And that was a show called Pretty Ugly. And that was the result of lots of research I was doing at the time around like teenage girls online. I'm like constantly fascinated by teenage girl culture. I think it's like such like fertile territory for art making. And, you know, I see them as like the progenitors of like culture and fashion and language. And, but also they're like so often not credited for all those things as well.
Right. In Sex and the City, they said, what was it? I don't know if you remember this episode where she had like, Samantha had a boyfriend, like this young actor boyfriend.
Yeah.
And then she was like trying to mentor him. And she was like, listen, first the gays, then the girls, then everyone.
That's the hierarchy.
Yeah, that's how it goes. That's how everyone finds you. Yeah.
Yeah,
so the teenage girls are in there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And so, this project at the time, called Pretty Ugly, it was about kind of like how teenage girls were using the internet. And it was, I was kind of like doing lots of research into like teenage girls speak online and stuff. And then I happened across this kind of like online phenomenon. It was a trend at the time where basically like teenage girls were posting videos of themselves on YouTube, asking viewers to comment whether they were pretty or ugly. And the videos were just kind of like the most like fascinating and awful thing that I'd ever seen. You know, this like real, like cringeworthy, like overly earnest, kind of like beautifully intimate and tender moments that like the girls were sort of, you know, making these videos of themselves. And then you'd like scroll down and look at the comments, and obviously they were like disgusting and being like heavily trolled, and these girls were being told to like, you know, go kill themselves or whatever. And I was just completely fascinated. There were like 500,000 of these videos on YouTube at the time. And I guess like it got me wondering, like, why would all these girls participate in a trend where they were basically like throwing themselves into the lion's den? And so, yeah, the next thing for me that became like the clear next move, I guess, as a performance artist, was to come up with my own sort of three teenage alter egos at the time. And so I created these three different alter egos. I gave them like email addresses, different online presences. And then I made my own like, am I pretty or ugly videos, posted them. And then I think within a week, like two of them had gone viral, and I had this like influx of like messages and like all this like hate mail and, you know, like older men saying like, can't tell if you're pretty or ugly. Send me some nudes and I'll let you know, like just, you know, real gross stuff. And then, yeah, basically those videos lived live on the internet for like a year. And during that time, I was kind of like making the show about the experience of living as these three teenage girls online. And then just as I was about to premiere the show in London, I still hadn't like worked out whether I wanted to kind of like out myself as those sort of online personalities yet. But then something happened, which meant that I had to take those videos down, which was that essentially I'd been speaking to people online as these like alter egos for a while, kind of, you know, making little friends here and there, responding to messages from guys. And there was one guy in particular who had messaged all three of my alter egos, not obviously realizing that it was the same person. And yeah, basically, I'm not going to go into too many details here, but let's just say like as the sort of conversation progressed, it turned out that he was essentially like a known online predator. And yeah, I like completely freaked out about it, spoke to the artistic director of the theatre that I was premiering the show at in London. And he said, like, we absolutely can't let you premiere this show without you speaking to the police about it. So then I had to have this like wild conversation with the Met Police where I kind of got wrapped on the knuckles because they were like, you shouldn't be like doing this like undercover investigation yourself. And yeah, the whole thing was just like completely wild and way too much for me, you know, as a kind of baby artist at the time, like thinking I was doing the right things, you know, following the like artistic impulses.
You did their work for them. You got them evidence.
I know. It was such a weird situation. Like I really didn't expect like to get told off by them when I reported it. Yeah, it was absolutely wild. But yeah, what happened after that? So then what happened after that is like, so I took the videos down. I premiered the show in London. And then I think because the show was quite zeitgeisty at the time, I did like one sort of press interview with Wired magazine, and that interview went viral. And then I was like finding myself being like interviewed by like breakfast TV all over the world. And the show was getting loads of publicity. It was like on the TV and radio all over the, you know, all of the newspapers in the UK. And then the interesting thing that happened after that is then I started, after having this experience of these like three sort of undercover alter egos being trolled online, from the point when the story went viral, I then started getting trolled as an artist as well. And all these like internet sleuths like managed to piece together the story about the show, and they found my like the videos of me on YouTube and pieced it all together. And yeah, the whole thing was just like absolutely mad. And I think, yeah, let's just say like it, yeah, lots of like hard lessons were learned as a baby artist with that show. So, yeah.
I mean, that's incredible work you did. And that's just so brave to just put yourself in that. And also, fuck the police. Like, what the hell are they doing? Like, you did their, you were like, here is evidence. They, yeah. Like, that's the part of, like, at the TV show where they're like, you know, or whatever, Matlock goes in or whoever. It's just like, I did this for you, cops. And they're like, thanks. Like, what is wrong?
Yeah. No, I know. Yeah, the whole thing was weird. And I think also, like, something, so, like, obviously we'll get onto Fame Hungry in a bit. Like, I think I've just been thinking loads about that show because I think Fame Hungry is a kind of, like, return to, like, me looking at, like, internet culture and internet celebrity and, like, the experience of being trolled and stuff. But I think something, like, just to, like, talk a little bit about my little bruised artist ego for a moment. I think something that's been interesting is, like, looking back, you know, like, 10, 11 years apart at the experience of, like, so, I mean, I'm doing quite well with Fame Hungry at the moment, but Pretty Ugly, like, it went viral and it became a sort of, like, little, like, theatre sensation in London at the time. And I think I, although I was, like, really proud of the work, and I can look back and say I'm really proud of the work, I think I just so was not ready for that amount of attention. And I think when I was, like, doing all these press interviews and, like, speaking about the work, I was almost, like, cringing at the time. And so there was a sort of feeling of, like, don't look at me, don't look at me, even though, like, there was obviously part of me which was, you know, out in the world making the work that I wanted to make. But I just, I wasn't ready for that sort of level of attention and fame, I think, at that time, which is interesting, like, looking back on it now, because Fame Hungry is kind of exploring, like, what it's like to be, like, thirsty for that kind of attention. So, yeah.
It's just how did you recover from that?
How did I recover? I mean, what a great question. Like, slowly and also not at all. I think, you know, something else that I've been thinking about is that, you know, I feel like we're so good now in sort of in the art world about talking about, like, mental health and, you know, self-care and talking about accessibility and stuff. And I think back then there was no chat about that at all. And I think it took me a couple of years to realize that actually the whole experience had been, I mean, I really don't want to overstate this, but it had been, a little bit traumatic, I guess. And brought up a lot of things for me. But I think, I don't know, I think I just sort of, like, you know, I did a bit of a, like, stiff English upper lip thing and just powered through. And then when that project was over, I was like, right, on to the next one. And I think it's only been, the last few years when I've been sort of looking back and making sense of it all. I'm like, oh, yeah, actually, some things about that whole experience were not comfortable for me, but I never really spoke to anyone about it.
Wow, that's a stiff upper lip. That is a stiff, I mean, I have some sound effects here. That's a stiff upper lip. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
So how do you, like, train to be a performer? Because you went to school for this, right?
Like, yes and no. I think, so I did, so I went to university and I did, like, an initial, I did my undergrad in English and drama. But it was like less like drama school training and more just like academic, if you know what I mean. There was some practical stuff involved. And then I did an MA, so postgrad in performance practice and research. And again, like, I would say that was, like, less like training and more like critical theory, and sort of it was very looking at things from quite an academic lens. But sure, you know, like, I guess in terms of performance art, maybe that is one of the best trainings. You know, you do kind of look at things quite conceptually. And, you know, I mean, this sounds so lame to say, but, like, I've got to be honest about the fact that when I was doing my postgrad, I was just, like, really inspired by Marina Abramović, like, duh, of course, like, every performance artist is. And so I think, maybe you could argue that you don't need loads of training to like, become a performance artist in that way, in terms of, like, drama school training or whatever. But I was doing a lot of kind of experiments, I would say, like, through that year of doing my MA. And then I think, you know, the first, like, couple of years post graduating, I was making much more of that kind of, like, body-based, like, quite hardcore performance artwork, like the kind of work that maybe, like, goes into a gallery space. And I found that, like, since then, now I'm moving towards, like, more, like, entertainment-y, you know, theatrical experiences, I guess.
Very cool. Very cool. And in New York right now, there's like a lot, and in England as well, your guys are actually way more ahead of us in this, but it's the move towards comedy going to absurd and like clowning becoming such a huge, huge thing. And in New York, there's some people who, I mean, there's debate, you know, what is clown? No one really knows. There's some circles that people are like, no, that's performance art because it's not, you know, there's this, I mean, I'm not into gatekeeping. I can give a shit less what people, you know, am I affected by this performance? That's all I care about. But like, it's an interesting line, trying to figure out like what's, and am I myself, like I've done a lot of sketch characters and I've used those in what I would consider performance art projects. Like I did this performance art project where I was like, I filmed myself next to a fire for like 45 minutes continuous as the character and like explored what it was like to be them. And then I like put them in frames and then, got a little gallery space, like got it into a gallery. So that was like really fun and like really fulfilling. And I feel like I was able to like do something beyond like constraints of like a 5 minute comedy set, you know, and be able to expand. But I was very conscious that this is not, you know, this is something else. I guess, where do you, like in terms of, do you see a lot of clown? Like, where do you see those lines falling or? Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting because I feel like, I mean, when I was doing my MA, I did a little bit of like, I think I did a few work, a sort of clown workshops, clown slash performance art workshops.
Yeah.
And I can totally see how those things are like, kind of blur, you know, depending on like, the context and the spaces that they're in. When I was sort of like coming up as a baby artist, I didn't see that many clowns in the sort of performance art space, but really interestingly, the last few years, I've seen more and more and more, like some amazing, like, I guess one of the people that I'm thinking about at the moment is like Julia Masley. There's like loads of people in London who have that kind of like crossover practice. And actually I've been working with a few artists, like as a director recently or as a mentor, who are again in the performance art space, but they've had a sort of clown background.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I am definitely seeing that more and more.
Oh, that's interesting. And do you think, like, one thing I've heard is someone say, like, performance artists don't include the audience in the experience, but clowns do. Do you think that's true?
Not in my experience, no.
Yeah, because you're so inclusive of the audience.
And, like,
all
of my work has, like, been participatory in, like, one way or another, like... Yeah, so no, I don't think I would agree with that. No. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
I don't know. I also think that that's just a really interesting thing because I just feel like all art is kind of in relationship with an audience, like whether there's a fourth wall or not. Do you know what I mean? It's like...
Right.
And I think, I don't know, for me, whatever you label it, the work that's the most exciting is the work that is most honest about that relationship to the audience or considers it the most or, you know, thinks about that kind of feedback loop as well between the artist and the audience. I think a lot of my work, I try to like create spaces where kind of unexpected things can happen between an artist and an audience. And, you know, and then you get that feeling of like risk and liveness. I think, you know, that's the stuff that really, really drives me.
Yeah, for sure. I feel like sometimes like these designations are just ridiculous. I feel like at the end of the day, like at the top of the mountain, like the people who are the best at what they do, it's all kind of the same. Like in the, I mean, in terms of like affecting an audience, making people feel something, you know, it's we're in the same game, but like maybe different ways to get there.
No, definitely. And I think it's interesting as well, because I think like 10 years ago, I was probably like way more paranoid or anxious or about like how I labeled myself as an artist, you know, like for example, I probably didn't even use the term performance artist then. I would have used the term live artist, which felt like it fit more in that sort of like fine art world, maybe.
Right.
And if anyone came to see a show of mine and called it a play, I would have like, you know, like vomited in front of them.
Right.
Like, it was just like, I was like, absolutely not. I do not want to be like part of the theatre world. And now I just actually don't give a damn too much, you know. It's just beyond, I think my only like caveat to what I just said is that I think what I have learned is that it is useful to tell the audience a little bit about that, what they, the kind of experience that they're going into, because I think for example, if someone came into Fame Hungry thinking they were coming to see a play, I think that they might find it really confusing.
Yeah.
Like, why is this bit going on for so long? Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, yeah.
Interesting. I find, because I have had people call me a performance artist. They've said, oh, this is clown. I just call it comedy because American audiences are so afraid of doing something a little bit. It would be hard. It's harder to get an audience that way than to be like, this is a comedy show.
Well, this is good to know, because have I told you that I'm coming to do 3 weeks in New York in January?
What? What, in January? Yes. I think you might have mentioned it briefly. Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, so I'm going to be at Soho Playhouse doing Fame Hungry for 3 weeks.
Oh my God, I didn't know that. Oh wow, what are the dates?
So it's like January 22nd to February the 8th.
Okay, we're going to arrange this to get this out there before then. That's very exciting. Yay, so exciting. Thanks. Wow. That's going to get a clown horn. Okay. All right.
Thanks.
But yeah, I'm interested to hear what your experience then is of like marketing and sharing the show, because that's always good to understand. And so Playhouse is different. So yeah, everyone's experience is different. So curious, yeah, like how that goes. It's going to be so exciting. I'm going to come see it again. Let's talk about Fame Hungry, because I've told so many people about this show. I think it was the best show I saw at the Fringe of any type of show.
Thank you.
Because I brought my friend with me and he was like, this is so good. Like, I know, this is great. Like during the show. So I don't know. So I guess my experience is I didn't know what to think of it. I was like looking to go to a lot of comedy shows because I'm a comedian and I'm going to go see like clown and stand up. I saw tons of stand up, tons of clown. And then I saw your show, like the advertisement was like, it looked quirky. Because it looked like this is something, and it was on a topic about this idea of internet authenticity and fame and what does it mean. It's something I think and talk about a lot. So I was like, all right, it's on a topic I like, and I think it has like the aesthetic of something I like. And I think maybe it's funny, but I'm not sure. I was like thinking it was going to be kind of funny, because that's like a lot of shows at the Fringe are. So that was my experience of it. And then I came and then I didn't know what to expect. And I liked that feeling. And then I was like, wow, this is so cool. So tell us about everyone, so everyone can understand, what is Fame Hungry?
Yeah. So Fame Hungry is a show about, it comes from a bit of a like existential question for me, which was basically like, am I reaching the end of my career? Is performance art dead? Do I have a future? And I guess all these sort of like questions were circling around for me, you know, especially over the pandemic, when we all lost our, you know, access to live performance and our livelihoods. And I guess I was like looking around at the time and considering like, should I be trying to like move into like working in TV and film, or like train as a therapist like loads of my friends did. Did you have that experience?
Yeah, that's funny. I know so many people who are like doing performance.
Yeah, it seems to be a bit of a trend among my artist pals. It's quite funny. Anyway, around the time, so I was having this kind of like existential dread around my practice, and like, you know, like in the pandemic as well, we kept on hearing all these awful statistics about how like UK theatres had lost half their audiences. Like when the theatres opened back up, like they had like, half the audiences had stayed at home. They didn't want to come back to the theatre. And around the time I'd like met this teenager through running drama workshops, who's called Jax. And I found out one day through our conversations that they were on TikTok and that they had a TikTok following of like 50,000 people. And let's just say it just blew my mind. And then I guess that's kind of when like the sort of idea for Fame Hungry started, because I was like, right, I'm a performance artist. I'm not quite at the top of my game, but I've been doing this for a while. I've got, you know, a bit of a name and a profile here in the UK, but I am losing work. People aren't programming performance art as much. Audiences aren't coming back to theatres. And here I'm working with a 15-year-old teenager who is regularly performing to an audience of 50,000 people. And so the show started with the sort of like maths of that, like, what am I doing? Where am I going wrong here? Like, and then this sort of question began to form of what would it be like to be mentored by a 15-year-old TikToker? And so that's how the show began. The sort of research journey was for the show was that I then spent a year kind of undercover on TikTok trying to build up a profile. I was being mentored by this teenage TikToker in all the ways of like trying to find audiences and build up a profile. And then from that point onwards, we started making the show together. And yeah, I guess the show as it is, it's a kind of, it's a sort of like innovative multimedia experience, I guess. The sort of question of the show is, I am essentially on stage, I'm streaming to a live TikTok audience on TikTok Live. And I tell that audience that if they can get me to 20,000 likes, then I'll do something amazing. I'll reward them with something amazing. And that's the kind of like basis of the show. It's this kind of like game that I'm playing with the TikTok audience to see if I can get to the end of the show, to see if I can get to do the amazing thing. All the meanwhile, the theatre audience are then watching this kind of like precarious game with the TikTok audience. And at the same time, I'm kind of giving this theatre audience a kind of behind the scenes view of like that year long journey, all the conversations that I had with Jack. So yeah, I mean, it's so, I always find it so complicated to explain it, because it's essentially like two shows in one. You know, there's a kind of like fake show, quote unquote fake show, that's happening for the TikTok Live audience, where I'm kind of pretending to be a TikToker. And then there's also the theatre show, which is happening, which is very different to the TikTok experience, where I'm, yeah, essentially like posing all these questions about like the future of performance art, and all the time like trying to sneak performance art past the TikTok censors as well, and sort of play the game of the algorithm. Yeah, did I explain that well?
I think that was pretty much, that was it. That was it. Was Jax actually live with you?
Yes. Yeah, so many people question that. So yeah, so that's the final sort of bit, I guess, that I didn't put in the explanation, is that, so Jax actually performs the show with me every day, and they perform live on Zoom. And so we have like a big monitor at the side of the stage where essentially Jax is like mentoring me through this game on TikTok Live. And yeah, loads of people think that it's a pre-record, which actually I feel like that would be so much more difficult to perform with a pre-record, but no, they were performing live from their bedroom every day, which I also loved. Yeah. I don't know if you came to one of the shows where they had like a friend in the background.
No. That's amazing. I was just more impressed that Jack showed up every day.
I know. Yeah, bless them. I mean, it's funny because we've just been doing some shows in Denmark, and they're at some weird times of the day. So yeah, and when we're in New York as well, Jax is going to have to be up. Wait, am I doing the maths of this right? They're going to have to be up pretty late at night, I think.
Yeah.
To perform the show. Yeah.
Wow. And they're committed.
Yeah, fully committed. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, you know, one of the things that is explored in the show a little bit is this like kind of unlikely relationship between me and Jax, where, you know, traditionally I'm almost like double their age. Traditionally I would be taking on the mentor figure, right? And they would be the mentee, but we've kind of like flipped the script on that a little bit. So Jax becomes my mentor. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that's kind of explored in the show is the idea that actually working with Jax, you know, obviously the sort of fake question of the show is like, can Jax teach me the ways of building audiences or like making money through the art of TikTok. But I think the sort of real question that's underneath that is actually, was actually me asking a question about hope, you know, mm-hmm. at the end of the day, like, where do we go from here? And when I say that, I don't just mean like, where do I go from here as a performance mm-hmm. artist in a world that's, increasingly monopolized by screens and digital culture and social media, but also where do we all go from here in terms of like how social media is changing the art world, how it's changing, you know, how we relate to each other, how we relate to ourselves. And I think sometimes I get a bit frustrated with this idea that because of social media, the world's going to shit, you know, and like Gen Z like are just addicted to their screens and, you know, we're all going to turn into robots or zombies or whatever. And actually working with Jax, I was like, no, maybe they have a really different way of living their life. But actually I don't think it's necessarily like a wrong way. And there is still, through Jax, I saw that there are still ways of like being an artist or, you know, being a creative person, which gave me hope, I guess.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah.
How do you, cause I feel I have a little nephew who's 8 and he says to me, like, we make a list of like things we want to do together. And he's like, well, can you show me how to make a YouTube video? And I want to make my own channel. And then he asks me like, how many followers do you have? And I have to have a conversation with him. Cause I'm like, all right, we need to talk about this. The quality of the art and the likes you get are not the same thing.
Yeah.
And can we talk about it? And like, it has to come from, you have to feel your barometer for art making is just has to be separate from this. And that's hard. I mean, it's hard even for me. Yeah. How do you explain that to people? How do you and Jax talk about that?
Yeah. Well, I think that like Jax is really savvy about that stuff. You know, like Jax like 100% considers themselves an artist. When they first got into TikTok, they were they're also like a cosplayer as well. So I think like a lot of the content that they were putting out was like based on their favorite TV or anime series or whatever. And they were just like really enjoying like getting into cosplay and making these little videos. And I think somewhere along the way, as they've got older, and we had some really real conversations about this, like they realized that their videos did a bit better when they were wearing less clothes, for example, or, you know, when they took on certain characters which were maybe a bit more femme presenting or a bit less weird looking. And I think, you know, Jax isn't oblivious to that at all. But I think that I think they're just really canny about it, you know? They're just like, okay, I know that if I do something which is a bit more thirst trappy, then I'm going to get loads of likes. And if I do this thing, then I'm not going to get so many likes. But actually, they talk about how it doesn't change the enjoyment for them about what they're putting out there. Although we also have had conversations about how that's been a lesson that they've had to learn, you know? But again, you know, it's like there's just so much stuff that they were talking about their TikTok life where I was like, yeah, that's 100% been my experience as an artist as well. Just talking in different terms, right? Working in different mediums.
That's great to know that it's not like they like don't use different, like they don't lose sight of what is really important and which is your artistic practice. Yeah. That makes me feel good. Yes. Okay.
Yeah. I think, you know, and I'm sure that there are maybe like other young people who have fallen into the trap a bit more than Jax has. And I think like Jax does talk in the show about how they've done, you know, have had quite a lot of difficult experiences online. And so they've had to do a lot of work. But I think, yeah, it just did give me hope.
Yeah. Well, the other, I was listening to the John Oliver segment. He did a whole thing last week on TikTok specifically, mm-hmm. and the potential TikTok ban in the U.S. And mm-hmm. one thing he brought up is that it's not just TikTok that like does a lot of the stuff that you talked about with TikTok, like monitoring and the way they run their algorithm and the way they're trying to, you know, they're censoring. Yeah. What do you think about that?
Oh, about the like censorship on social media.
Well, I think how it's not just is it just TikTok was a focus of the show, but obviously it's other companies as well. And did you explore that in your research at all?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I think, I know from other artists, for example, that I work with who do a lot more like body-based or like nude work, they are finding that they, you know, they're just censored all over social media.
Yeah.
And Instagram is particularly bad. But I do think that there's some, I think TikTok might be worse. I think my experience is that it is potentially one of the most conservative platforms out there. I think the reason that I sort of gravitated towards TikTok is that it seems like it's the most conservative, it's the most capitalist in the way that it is constantly trying to like get you to like sell shit and buy things on there in ways that other platforms aren't. And I also think, you know, it's the biggest one as well in terms of how many people use it. And also the other thing that I find really like endlessly interesting about it is that it's also the biggest one for young people as well. So I guess for me as an artist, considering all these questions, but also having a question about like the future, like what does the future look like? What does the future look like for young people? Then I have to look at the platform that has the most young people on it and how they're, you know, behaving on it.
Yeah.
A lot of the stuff that I found through that research journey was like hella apocalyptic, you know, like just some really dark stuff on there. I think one of the things that I find really weird about it, I mean, there's all the obvious things in terms of like it being like, you know, like censoring things and conservative and capitalist and stuff. But I think one of the things that I find really weird is like the like kind of language that you have to learn on there.
Yeah, that was like fascinating when you were talking about it. Yeah.
Like you're not allowed to say like suicide, you have to say, or died, you have to say like unalived, you know, like things like that. I'm just like, there's something like a bit nanny state about it that feels, kind of dark for me, kind of sinister. It was quite funny actually, speaking of that, we were doing a work in progress sharing of the show last year at a theatre in London. And we were just doing like a sort of 30-minute, you know, thing just to test out some of it in front of audiences. And one day just before we went live, we had like the theatre duty manager come in. And yeah, so we'd just gone live and we were just finishing like setting up the stage. And the duty manager came in and was like, "Oh, Louise, can you just remind me what the content warnings are for this show?" And she was like, "Haze, fast moving imagery, da 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 da." And then she was like, "Suicide." And then as soon as she said suicide, my screen lit up with like a restriction, because that's how the algorithm works, which is crazy to me as well. Like, I don't really know. I don't really understand the technology, like whether they've got like kind of like bots, like constantly like looking at what you're streaming, and that they like heard that word or there was someone watching. But as soon as that happened, we had a live restriction come up and the show hadn't even started.
Wow.
Yeah.
And when you're streaming live during the show.
Yeah.
And you've had TikTok like block you. And trolls come for you during the show.
Yes.
How do you handle that? I was just like, I'm so mystified by that. The pressure. Oh my God.
Yeah. Well, I think it's funny because people are often like, "Oh, how do you manage it?" And I'm like, do you know what? Like, I've had 15 years of hardcore performance artist training where I've had like horrible things happen to me in shows. And, you know, I'm always like, so much of my work is about like putting myself in kind of like risky or uncomfortable positions in front of audiences. So I think like stuff like that doesn't faze me too much. Obviously, like the thing that you're referring to is that, like, all the way through Edinburgh, we were having TikTok just like throw us off. And so I had to have all these like multiple backup accounts. And I think, you know, on the one hand, it really added to kind of like the message of the show in terms of like, what does it mean to be an artist working in like hyper-capitalist conservative systems now? And also, you know, like there's a fun jeopardy that I'm playing with the audience of like, am I going to get thrown off TikTok? Am I not? Let's see what happens today. So that's all kind of like fun. But then on the other hand, there's the reality of like, okay, I've got like 5 backup accounts left. I've got 25 shows to get through in Edinburgh. Like, is there a real chance I'm actually not going to be able to do the show one day? So yeah, that was a bit nerve wracking, definitely.
So you made it through.
Huh?
You made it through.
Yeah, I absolutely made it through. And then obviously the other thing that happens is, yeah, like the constant trolling as well. I mean, on some of the best show days when we're not kicked off loads, sometimes we can have up to 3,000 people watching on TikTok. And I think the thing that's really interesting there is like, obviously like with the theatre audience, they've bought tickets to come and see the show. They know that they know they're going to sit down in the dark for an hour and watch me do something. But with the TikTok audience, you know, they're probably coming across me whilst they're like, you know, making dinner or watching TV or on the bus home or whatever, and like finding me on their feed going like, what's this weird like performance art nonsense that's happening? And then, you know, they can watch from anywhere between like 30 seconds or to the full show.
Yeah.
And, you know, often because they don't know what's happening, or because obviously like a lot of the things that I do in the show is like ultimately to provoke the TikTok audience, I'll get like heavily trolled as well. Yeah, but that's also kind of fun, I think, for the theatre audience to watch, you know, that sort of, that game, I guess, that I'm playing.
Wow. And then did you have a director for it?
No, I didn't.
Wow.
Traditionally the way that I make work is that I kind of direct myself, which...
That's incredible, Louise. That's incredible. That gets clamor. Okay, yeah, that's amazing.
Thank you so much.
Oh my God, this is like, how do you trust yourself so much?
I mean, yeah, what a great question.
It's amazing.
How do I trust myself? I think that ultimately, like, the way I make my work is I'm super visual. And I think, like, I've got often, like, at the beginning of making something, I've got a really strong instinct about how I want something to look or feel. And then I just try and like follow that instinct as hard as possible. But yeah, I mean, also this is not to say that I don't have other people who come in. So I don't work with a director, but I do towards the end of the making process, I'll often get in maybe a dramaturg or an outside eye, and then I'll have a few sessions with them. And those sessions are really just like for me to say like, right, how is it reading to you? You know, how are an audience reading this? And then sort of like us like comparing notes about how I want it to be reading and how it is reading. And, you know, I think my first few shows, I didn't work with an outside eye. And I think, yeah, I've learned that it is a necessary part of the process for sure.
It's so mystifying to me because I don't trust myself. So I feel like that's like you have didn't you putting it out there. I'm inspired. I'm super inspired.
I mean, it's funny though, because I feel like I have thought more and more like what would it be like for me to work with a director, and actually like maybe that would be a good thing for me to do next. Mm-hmm. But I also do wonder, like, just to be really honest, whether I'm too much of a control freak as well.
Oh, I mean, you've had success, so it's like, well, like they tell you to do something, you're like, well, yeah, but I did kind of make a few successful shows, so I might know what I'm talking about. My way.
Yeah, maybe. But yeah, also, you know, always looking for ways to like level up or experiment.
Yeah, so, of course. Yeah, who knows? Yeah, who knows? So we have two things we always do in the show, mm-hmm. and we have something called a misfit moment. Mm-hmm. That's the moment you knew that the traditional world was not going to be for you.
As in, when was that moment?
Yeah, what was that moment? Yeah. Could it be a faraway moment or a recent, you know, whatever, you're just like,
Wow, do you know, I'm just going to go with the first thing that just flew into my head, which is probably means it's the right thing. But when I was a teenager and I was at school, I had this amazing drama teacher who came in just for the last 2 years of my school experience. And she took us to this show by this theatre company called DVA. They're a UK theatre company. And they made this like mad experimental kind of like physical theatre in the 90s. Always had like very quite pretty like hard themes. And she took us to see a show called The Cost of Living. And it just absolutely blew my mind. And I think that was the moment that I was like, yeah, this is like, I think maybe before then I'd thought like, I wanted to be, well, interestingly, I always thought I either wanted to be an actress or a journalist, which I think is quite funny now because I think I'm making work that's like somewhere in the middle of those two things. But I think, yeah, when she took us to see that show, I was like, oh no, actually, like, I don't want to perform other people's plays. I don't want to perform other people's words. Like, I want to make work like these people do. And I think, yeah, I'll always remember that moment.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Mm. And we also have a question about you're the thing when you're in the downs, you know, there's up, there's down, the down. Mm. The stuff, the inspiration, the misfit inspiration, if you will, about how to get that stiff upper lip in. Get going.
Well, these are really good questions. I think, do you know what? I know I'm in a place where things are good and I've done good things in my career, but I also have had so much failure as well and so much rejection. And I think the thing that that always happens is I just allow myself to like grieve it, like cry, have a tantrum, whatever. But then it's always like, for me, I'm like, okay, next, like just always, it's like, what's next? And I think, I don't know if that's because like ultimately I'm just an optimist potentially, but I think it's kind of about like keeping moving for me always. And I think I always just go like, right, okay, this is the thing that maybe didn't work, but maybe the next one will. And I think I've heard that over and over again from like artists that inspire me as well, that like with art making, it's a numbers game. It really is. Like you've got to keep making. You don't know like when the thing is going to be the right thing, or when the timing's going to be right, or you're going to be in the right place. And so I think you just have to keep moving. And I think that's the thing that I always think about, like, just keep moving. Like this one might not be my big one, but the one when I'm 50 might, you know?
Right. And you just don't know.
Yeah.
You just got to keep it going. I love it. I love that.
Yeah.
Okay, and I have a character. I have a question for my character. I'm going to bring over my Aunt Carmela. She's from Boca Raton, Florida, and she's because she's going to come and explain. So, Aunt Carmela, hi, Louise. How's it going? Nice to see you. I'm here. You know, they made me come up at Thanksgiving because I got to spend time with them. Yeah, exciting. So, listen. I want to know. You do lots of weird stuff. I love it. I love the weirds. Laura brings me around the weirds all the time. They're my favorite. There's not the people, the down where I am, I live with a bunch of old people. They're so fucking boring. I can't. So I like to do the weird things. So I'm going to come to your show for sure. I'm just curious. What does your family say? How do you deal with them? What do they say?
What do my family say? Like, how do they describe it? Or like, what's their response to it?
Well, what are they like? My daughter does the thing.
Yeah. Well, my dad probably doesn't, because he doesn't come to my work anymore, which probably says something in itself. And what does my mom say? She says, I don't really understand it, but I'm proud of her. That's what she says. I don't really get it.
Oh, that's exciting.
I'm her biggest fan. That's what she always says.
That's sweet.
Yeah.
That's sweet. Your dad, that says it about him. You know, he needs to be at the show. Yeah. That's the one. He needs to be at the show. Yeah. But what are you going to do? It's like my brother Lou, you know, he doesn't want to do nothing. He just wants to sit there and eat his donut in the morning and dunk it in the coffee like a moron. So what are you going to do?
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
Yeah.
You know, like I say, you know, people get mad and, you know, like, oh, they're not listening. They don't want to hear it. It's not for them. And just move on. There's other people. There's billions of people in the world who need you. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So good to see you. I'll see you in New York. I'm going to come to your show. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, she likes you. She's going to pour a martini. She's pouring a martini. She likes you that much. She's like,
I love it.
Party time.
You can tell her that she can watch me on TikTok as well.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right.
That's what my mum's done. It's absolutely wild. From my mum being like, I don't really understand this work. And also, I don't understand TikTok. She's now like been watching me like every single show on TikTok, which I find absolutely crazy.
We love that. We love that. Yeah.
And we're like, hi, mum. Welcome back. It's quite cute as well. I know we have to finish, but I've like, one of the things that's been kind of amazing about Fame Hungry is like, I've also like, as well as the trolls who come back, I've also like developed like a little group of like fangirls who come back to like watch the show every night on TikTok as well. And now they've started seeing my mom as well. So now they start saying like, hi, Pam, in the comments, which is really cute.
So are they able to follow you when you get kicked off and you have to go to a backup account?
Yeah. So they've like now found all my backup accounts. Yeah. Which actually, I don't really know how that's happened. I guess they're all kind of under similar names. But yeah, there's this group of people like, I don't think... like they don't know each other. They're all from different like parts of the world. And now they like see each other at every show and they're like, hey, Katie, hey, Chris, like, how's it going? And often like through the first bit of the show, I can see them having a little chat about like, yeah, things are good. Like did this today. Da-da-da-da-da. It's really cute.
That's adorable. You're giving them like a space to get to know like other weirdos who just want to like connect. That's
exactly.
Beautiful.
Exactly.
That's great. We
watch
love
some weird things online.
Yeah. They're like little, they're performing a performance art fan club right there. Exactly. The original. It's happened here. It has happened. It happened here. You've seen it. Perfect. Great. Well, where can people come find you, find out about more about the show, et cetera, even beyond January?
Yeah. So, Instagram. So I'm at Louise Orwin on Instagram. I put everything on there. So then in New York, I'll be at Soho Playhouse January 22nd to February the 8th. You can find tickets on the Soho Playhouse website. And then also the other thing where if you're interested about my work and you want to know more, then the best place to go to is my website, which is louiseorwin.com. And yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been lovely. I've loved it.
I love it as well. Yes. We'll see you in New York.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, there you have it. You can follow the podcast on my page at Lauren Logie. Updates and inside info on my email list, LaurenLogie.com. Thank you to Annie McCutcheon for editing, Edward Stilla at Radio Misfits Podcast Network, and Maddie McLennan for making the podcast art. Thanks to our listeners for bringing us back for another season. We'll see you soon.